The clock says 3 o'clock, so I think we may as well start now, especially because after the talk is finished, because it's a Sunday, I have to go to church. And there's an interfaith thing at St. George's at 5 o'clock, so I'll start now. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Bhutang dhammang sangkhang namassami. So the sutta which I've chosen for today is the 89th sutta in the middle length sayings called the Monuments to the Dhamma. The reason I chose this one because I realized there was a sutta class today, and on Thursday I was in Singapore and I just opened up a book and that was what came up, the Monuments to the Dhamma. It's also a favorite sutta of mine, even though I'm sure that Ajahn Bhamali has probably taught this before, but obviously a long time ago. The reason why I like this sutta, because it gives a snapshot of what the monasteries were like, the Sangha was like, especially in the time of the Buddha, and why it was like that way. So here we go. Thus have I heard, on one occasion the Blessed One was living in the Sakyan country, where there was a town of the Sakyans named Medalumpa. Sakyan country seemed to be just a territory which was basically controlled by the king of Kosala, but given some autonomy. Now, on that occasion, King Prasenadi of Kosala had arrived at Nagarika for some business or other. There he addressed Digha-Karayana. He was his senior general. Dear Karayana, have the state carriages prepared. Let us go to the pleasure garden to see a pleasing spot. Yes, sire, Digha-Karayana replied. And when the state carriages were prepared, he informed the king, sire, the state carriages are ready for you. You may go at your own convenience. Then King Prasenadi mounted a state carriage, and accompanied by the other carriages, he drove out from Nagarika with the full pomp of royalty and proceeded towards the park. He went thus as far as the road was passable for carriages, and then dismounted from his carriage and entered the park on foot. As he walked and wandered in the park for exercise, King Prasenadi saw roots of trees that were lovely and inspiring, quiet and undisturbed by voices, with an atmosphere of seclusion, remote from people, favorable for retreat. The sight of these reminded him of the Blessed One, the Buddha, thus, these roots of trees are lovely and inspiring, quiet and undisturbed by voices, with an atmosphere of seclusion, remote from people, favorable for retreat. Like the places where we used to pay respect to the Buddha, accomplished and fully enlightened. Then he told Digha-Karayana what he had thought and asked, where is he living now, the Buddha, accomplished and fully enlightened? Now the first point from that paragraph is that in those days the places where the Buddha and the monks would stay were in such beautiful places. The roots of trees that are lovely and inspiring, quiet, undisturbed by voices, with an atmosphere of seclusion, remote from people, favorable for retreat. This is one of the reasons why that when we built Dhammasara Monastery, Bodhinyana Monastery or Jhana Grove, we try and live up to that requirement, for a place where people can meditate. To be remote, but not so remote that even a king can't visit it, but to be quiet enough with an atmosphere of seclusion. So you can actually see why the forest tradition started. The idea of a forest tradition, the word forest, is a little bit of a skewed translation. It's usually called the Aranya, which literally means wilderness, uncontrolled by a government or a king. basically outside of the city and the environment of the city. That's what's called Aranya, unruled. It doesn't mean there are trees there. It could be a desert. It could be a mountain. It could be any place which fulfills what you see here. A park which is nice trees, inspiring, quiet, undisturbed voices with an atmosphere of seclusion, remote from people. So that was the idea of a place actually to go. And so, having gone to such a park just for a bit of peace and quiet, as kings would probably want to do, then he asked, reminded him of the places where the Buddhist monks lived, so he asked, where is the Buddha living now? And the general replied, there is, sire, a town of the Sakyans named Medalumpa. The Blessed One, accomplished and fully enlightened, is now living there. How far is it from Nagaraka to Medalumpa? It is not far, sire, 3 leagues. There is still daylight enough to go there. And leagues is a yojana. It was a unit of distance in Pali, which was as far as an ox cart could go in one day. No one really knows how much it is. Some people say about 10 kilometers, 12 kilometers. So you see three of those on an ox cart. If you had a carriage with horses, it obviously gets there far quicker. So he could get there in one day. Then, dear Karayana, have the state carriages prepared. Let us go and see the Buddha, the Blessed One, accomplished and fully enlightened. Yes, sir, he replied. And when the state carriages were prepared, he informed the king, sire, the state carriages are ready for you. You may go at your own convenience. Then King Prasena mounted a state carriage and, accompanied by the other carriages, set out from Nagaraka towards the Sakyan town of Medalumpa. He arrived there while it was still daylight and proceeded towards the park. He went thus as far as the road was passable for carriages, and then he dismounted from his carriage and entered the park on foot. Now, on that occasion, a number of bhikkhus were walking up and down in the open. Walking up and down in the open, that means they were doing that walking meditation called chankama. In fact, they say chankamati in the Pali. So that walking meditation, which we do today, it was done in the time of the Buddha as well. And this was out in the open. Just obviously, this will be the evening time sometime, maybe late afternoon, it was still light. And they were doing their walking meditation. And so the king went to them and asked, Venerable sirs, where is he living now, the Blessed One, accomplished and fully enlightened? We want to see the Blessed One, accomplished and fully enlightened. And the monks replied, that is his dwelling, great king, with a closed door. Go up to it quietly, without hurrying. Enter the porch, clear your throat and tap on the panel. The Blessed One will open the door for you. It's what I was always taught before you open any door, is actually to cough first of all, and then tap on the door. And especially it's a rule of Vinaya when you go into the toilet. Because that's what we're always taught to do, to cough first of all, to see if there's somebody inside. And because sometimes you burst inside and someone's already in there. And it can be very embarrassing. So I remember there was all sorts of stories where it was embarrassing, when some of the monks have actually gone to a person's house and they've gone to been to the toilet and they had coughed, but people didn't know what they were told they were doing, and they opened the door and there's still somebody inside. So this is what we have to do. So it's a tradition. Clear your throat and tap on the panel. The Blessed One will open the door for you. And King Prasenadi handed over his sword and turban to Diga Karayana then and there. Because if you go and see the Buddha, all of the worldly things like a wealthy jewelry, or in this case a sword and his turban, which is just like his crown of state, that all gets taken off. So you see the Buddha not as a king but as an ordinary person. And of course I too remember when I was wandering in Thailand at the time where there was a very serious insurgency in the northeast of Thailand, where there were many communist groups. These were insurgents who were Thai people just after the fall of Vietnam and Laos and Cambodia were fighting against the government, trying to make Thailand a communist place. And they were killing people, even killing monks. And so when I was in the jungle there, there were the soldiers who were on patrol. But when they came to see me, I was sitting there and the soldiers came. They'd always put their guns down, maybe about 10 meters away, and then they would come and say hello. They would never bring their guns in front of a monk, even though it could be dangerous for them. It could be a trap. It was a tradition which you can see here from the time of the Buddha. Yes, there are people in the army. Yes, there are sort of violence in the world. But when you come in the presence of a monk, the guns stay outside. I thought it was really quite cute. And then they put their guns down, they talked to me about all sorts of things, and then they went back and picked up their guns and carried on their patrol through the jungles. Really, I thought it was quite cute. And so this is, he took off his turban. So if a queen, if she were Queen Elizabeth, if she was a Buddhist and she came in here, she'd take off her crown and all her jewelry and come in here as an ordinary person. Even the King of Thailand, when he goes to a monastery, he would take off his shoes like everybody else. So outside his doors he'd be a king, inside he's an ordinary person, which is a very beautiful thing to see. And it was also very wonderful to see that in Thailand, that the people who sat at the front, closest to Ajahn Chah, they could be very poor villagers with hardly any money, but because they kept precepts, they were at the front, and these incredibly wealthy people had to be at the back. So in the temple, your status depends upon your precepts. But outside, it depends upon your wealth and other things. That is very beautiful. I've seen that so many times. I don't know if it's still the case, but it certainly was when I was a young monk. So he took off his sword, and he took off his turban, and he went to clear his throat, tapped on the panel, and the Blessed One opened the door. Then King Pasenadi entered the dwelling and prostrated himself with his head at the Blessed One's feet. And he covered the Buddha's feet with kisses and caressed them with his hands. Pronounced his name. I am King Pasenadi of Kosala, Venerable Sir. I am King Pasenadi of Kosala, Venerable Sir. As if the Buddha didn't know who that was. But it was a wonderful little vignette, a snapshot of just, not just the respect, but the sheer love and affection which this king had for his teacher, the Buddha. And of course, to put it in perspective, the Buddha, of his 45 years teaching, he spent 25 rains retreat, according to the texts, in the Jeta Grove Monastery in Sarwati, which was basically King Pasenadi's local monastery, just within walking distance from Sarwati, the capital of Kosala. So you could understand, and this actually happened towards the end of the king's life, in fact very close to the end of his life, and he was expressing just all those years of having known the Buddha as his teacher for 25 years, and as soon as he came in, just kissed his feet all over. It was very cute, very sweet. But I know some of you respect me a lot. Please don't do that for me. You will catch some terrible disease. So, and the Buddha said, "But great king, what reason do you see for doing such supreme honor to this body and for showing friendship?" Remember, he's saying, not to the Buddha, but to this body, kissing the body, that's respecting the body, and for showing such friendship. And this is where we get to the heart of the sutta now. "Venerable Sir, I infer according to Dhamma about this Blessed One. The Blessed One is fully enlightened. The Dhamma is well proclaimed by the Blessed One, and the Sangha of the Blessed One's disciples is practicing the good way. Now, Venerable Sir, I see some recluses and Brahmins." This is a term for people in different sects. In the time of the Buddha, it could be the Jains, it could be these wanderers called they're called wanderers. It could be the Ajivikas who are into other ascetic practices. There's many different types of religion in the time of the Buddha, pretty similar in the way that they were homeless and begged for alms. Some were much more ascetic. But he said, I see some of these recluse Brahmins living a limited holy life for 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, or 40 years. And then on a later occasion, I see them well-groomed, well-anointed with trimmed hair and birds, beards, enjoying themselves, provided and endowed with the five courses of sensory pleasure. In other words, living the ordinary life of going to movies and having sex and having a house. But here I see the bhikkhus leading the perfect and pure holy life as long as life and breath last. Indeed, I do not see any other holy life elsewhere as perfect and pure as this. This is why, Venerable Sir, I infer according to Dhamma about the Blessed One. The Blessed One must be fully enlightened. The Dhamma is well proclaimed by the Blessed One, and the Sangha of the Blessed One's disciples is practicing the good way. This is the fact where the nearly all of those monks, most of those monks, never disrobed. And that's very inspiring for him, to see monks living a long life in these robes and actually dying in the robes, which is a wonderful thing to see. I certainly remember when I first came here to Australia that sometimes people would sort of wonder, you know, these young men wearing brown robes, and they've been trained in Thailand. How long will they last? Is it really worthwhile having faith and trust in these young men who came here, first of all, Ajahn Chakra and myself? Will they really last? What's the point of building them a monastery if after a couple of years they're all going to disrobe again? And it's wonderful that I've been here for over 32 years now, 33 years now, and over 42 years now as a monk. So you can actually see this is the real thing. We last. It's not just a person does this to get them out of the system. It's not a phase I'm going through, as some of my friends used to say when I first became a monk. Oh, he'll get over this. Don't worry about me. But it's not a phase you're going through. Or one of the most interesting comments, because I was, when I did visit England once, and I was the attendant of Ajahn Sumedho when he gave a talk in Doncaster, and went for a walk with him in the morning. And in those days, the Buddhist monks were not very well understood. And so when a gentleman who was dressed for work, obviously a businessman, very well groomed, he passed us, he stopped by this Ajahn Sumedho, who was much older than I was, and he looked him up and down, and he gave one of the most withering criticisms I've ever heard. He looked at this monk and said, "You are old enough to know better." Poor Ajahn Sumedho. But here, because the king had seen these monks for a long time in the robes, it gives him a lot of faith. And again, Venerable Sir, and this is one thing we had a committee meeting, a very short committee meeting just now, and this is one which I was talking about for the committee. Again, Venerable Sir, kings quarrel with kings, nobles with nobles, Brahmins with Brahmins, householders with householder. Mothers quarrel with their sons, and sons quarrel with their mothers, fathers quarrel with their sons with their fathers. And in Buddhism, in the sutras, they go through all possible combinations, so please bear with us. Brothers quarrel with brothers, brothers with sisters, sisters with brothers, friend with friend. Actually, they don't say sister with sister, that's interesting, but anyway, that does happen. But here I see the monks living in concord, with mutual appreciation, without disputing, blending like condensed milk and tea. Oh, no, sorry, milk and water. In milk and water, viewing each other with kindly eyes. I do not see any other assembly with such concord. This too, Venerable Sir, is why I infer, according to the Dhamma, about the Blessed One. The Blessed One is fully enlightened. The Dhamma is well proclaimed by the Blessed One. The Sangha of the Blessed One's disciples is practicing the good way. And this is what he saw in the time of the Buddha. Something which, again, the monks and the nuns have to emulate and also not just the monks and nuns living in the monasteries, but also the lay disciples too. To have, well, people quarrel, but if you understand the Dhamma, you can live in concord. Yeah, you can disagree, but not with this terrible sense of an attack upon your integrity or your sense of self. You live in concord with mutual appreciation, the word I prefer the most. You appreciate one another and respect one another. People trying their very, very best, even though it may not be adequate by some people's standards, but they're trying their very best. And I know they are, without disputing, blending like milk and water. Milk is not water, water is not milk. They're different, but they can mix together. And viewing each other with kindly eyes, which again is a wonderful thing, to actually put kindness in the eyes and look at your wife, look at your husband, look at your fellow practicing the Dhamma, and just express that kindness, you know, through the eyes. And he said, I don't see other assemblies with such concord. This too, Venerable Sir, is why I infer, according to the Dhamma, the Blessed One. The Blessed One is fully enlightened, the Dhamma is well proclaimed by the Blessed One. The Sangha of the Blessed One's disciples is practicing the good way. So it's really important to have that type of concord. Mutual appreciation is really important. Is there any comments so far on this? Okay, now we get one of the most wonderful paragraphs, which I often quote, you know, in the various talks which I give in the world. Again, Venerable Sir, I have walked and wandered from park to park and from garden to garden. There I have seen some recluses and Brahmins who are lean, wretched, unsightly, jaundiced, with veins standing out of their limbs, such that people would not look at them again. And you have a look at myself and Venerable Keena, and that's certainly not a description you would apply to me. But when it says from park and gardens, these were the places where such people would reside. The pleasant places where a king would go for a little bit of exercise, there these people would be meditating, practicing, whatever they were doing. And he said, seeing all these recluses, wretched, unsightly, joined, his brain standing out on the limbs, such that people would not want to look at them again. And I have thought, surely these venerable ones are leading the holy life in discontent, or they have done some evil deed and concealing it, so lean and wretched are they. No understanding that the worry, unhappiness, will be a cause of such ill health. I went up to them and asked, why are you, Venerable Ones, so lean and wretched, such that people would not want to look at you again? And their reply was, oh, it's our family sickness, great king. But here, says the king, in this monastery, I see bhikkhus, smiling and cheerful, sincerely joyful, plainly delighting, their faculties fresh, living at ease, unruffled, subsisting on what others give, abiding with a mind as aloof as a wild deer's. I have thought, surely these venerable ones perceive successive states of lofty distinction in the Blessed One's dispensation, since they abide thus smiling and cheerful with a mind as aloof as a wild deer. This too, Venerable Sir, is why I infer according to the Dhamma about the Blessed One. The Blessed One is fully enlightened. The Dhamma is well proclaimed by the Blessed One, and the Sangha of the Blessed One's disciples is practicing the good way. And of course, this is a snapshot of what the monks would look like in the time of the Buddha. They were someone who weren't wretched and jaundiced and saying it's a family illness, but they were, I repeat this, smiling and cheerful, sincerely joyful, plainly delighting, faculties fresh, living at ease, unruffled, subsisting on what others give, abiding with a mind as aloof from the world as a wild deer. Very beautiful description of how a monastery should look and why people like to go to such a monastery instead of going to a monastery where people are always mean and wretched looking. And it's also the case that in many cultures they always think that monks should not be smiling. A smile means you're not understanding suffering. It's suffering, so shall we show your suffering. And because of that, I go to many places, especially recently gone to Korea and also Hong Kong. And I will never forget a comment which I got from an elderly Buddhist nun, a Mahayana nun, after I visited. Because she said, "Thank you so much for visiting Ajahn Brahm. You're a senior monk, you're well respected, and you were smiling." He said, "Before you came, I was not allowed to smile as a nun. But after you've been here, now I can be natural and smile and show my happiness." And it was a very telling little anecdote that because in some cultures you think, no, if you are smiling, you're not a good monk, not a good nun. And so I like pointing this out. This is what it was in the time of the Buddha, where the Buddha was the teacher, that the monks were smiling and cheerful, sincerely joyful, plainly delighting, their faculties fresh. Because such monks, such nuns, they are attractive. You would like to see them. It actually, just their presence brings some joy and happiness to you. The world is a very unhappy place sometimes. So you want to go to a monastery to see the monks smiling and cheerful. Sincerely joyful, plainly delighting, their faculties fresh. And also the most important part of this is the inference that the king said, "Surely these venerable ones are perceiving successive states of lofty distinction in the Blessed One's dispensation. The calm and the insights which come, those are the lofty distinctions." Because they were smiling and delighting, he inferred quite correctly that they have experienced some of the great insights and some of the great stillness of monastic life. Otherwise, he said, they would not be thus smiling and cheerful. "This too, venerable sir, is why I infer according to the Dhamma about the Blessed One. The Blessed One is fully enlightened. The Dhamma is well proclaimed by the Blessed One. And the Sangha of the Blessed One's disciples is practicing the good way." Any comments about that? I know that is the truth because I've been practicing for such a long time. You can tell, you know, who are the ones who have lofty distinctions by just how smiling and how happy they are. You may sort of not appreciate that, but that is a very good rule of thumb. And next, again, venerable sir, this is paragraph 13, "being a head anointed noble king, I am able to have executed those who should be executed, to fine those who should be fined, to exile those who should be exiled." That's how much power he has. "Yet, when I am sitting in council, they break in and interrupt me. Though I say, 'Gentlemen, do not break in and interrupt me when I'm sitting in council. Wait till the end of my speech.' Still they break in and interrupt me. But here I see monks, bhikkhus, while the Buddha is teaching the Dhamma to an assembly of several hundred followers, and then there is not even a sound of a disciple of the Blessed One coughing or clearing his throat. Once the Blessed One was teaching the Dhamma to an assembly of several hundred followers, and there a disciple of his cleared his throat. Thereupon one of his companions in the holy night nudged him with his knee to indicate, 'Be quiet, venerable sir, make no noise. The Blessed One, the teacher, is teaching us a Dhamma.' He didn't say that. He nudged him as if to say that. It is wonderful, it is marvelous how an assembly can be so well disciplined without force or weapon. Indeed, I do not see any other assembly anywhere so well disciplined. This too, venerable sir, is why I infer according to the Dhamma about the Blessed One. The Blessed One is fully enlightened. The Dhamma is well proclaimed by the Blessed One. The Sangha of the Blessed One's disciples is practicing the good way." Now, in particular there, he was the discipline which the king could not impose through force and through the punishments of even executing someone. And if he wanted to, he had that right. Firing them, exiling them, and still they're undisciplined, they'd interrupt him. But the Blessed One could do this without force, without weapon. And this is a very important part, the discipline of a human being. If you try force, weapons and punishments, it doesn't really take you that far. They're not so disciplined. But if you discipline them with the Dhamma, without force, without weapon, without punishment, there's another type of discipline. It's the inspiration, the discipline through respect, discipline through kindness and wisdom. That is the best type of discipline. And it's often asked of me, it was asked in the questions yesterday afternoon in the meditation class, what is right effort? How can you discipline the mind? In the same way that you discipline, the Buddha disciplined the monks, it was not through force or through weapons. It was through this wonderful kindness and wisdom. That is how you discipline the mind, in order to keep it nice and quiet. Just like the people would not interrupt the Buddha, would not even cough when the Buddha was giving... Okay. It's okay, you can't do that. I'm not the Buddha. And you're not so well. So even though no one would cough when the Buddha was giving a talk, so and he would do that without any force or weapon, so no one interrupt him. So the mind doesn't interrupt you when you're meditating. You see that similarly. You can meditate and the mind doesn't say anything or interrupt. If you know how to discipline your mind, not through force, not through weapons. It's a very powerful simile. Yes. You're saying, just I can repeat that for you. You're saying the prisons today, they're being able to discipline the prisoners, not through brute force and ignorance, you said, but with a bit of kindness. Absolutely. It's a wonderful way of disciplining even children. It takes a bit more time and effort and a lot of skill on the person, but it does actually work. They always say, treat people like an animal, and you make an animal. Treat people like a human being, and you make human beings. So with a little bit of kindness and respect, a discipline happens. And not a discipline which is imposed on the outside, but a discipline which is inspired from outside and arises from within. An inner discipline, understanding the meaning, rather than a discipline imposed by fear. I agree with you. You had a question? Okay, go on. Yes.
I was trained in 1989 for a while to become a correctional services officer in Melbourne, and I did time in Pentridge Prison as an officer. And what I found there, the training that I was given, I was taught to be kind, to listen, to stand back and observe, but also to be on top of the game as well.
Mm.
But I was not a key keeper, and I wasn't there to discipline or anything like that, just to observe and to make sure that they actually had someone to talk to. So when I went in, what I expected as a trainee was to see murderers, rapists, all that sort of thing. But I couldn't see that. I saw human beings.
Very good.
So I could only relate to them as human beings, plus my training and my own personality. I would play pool with them and they would have games of volleyball and that sort of thing with us. And to me, that was a lot happier within the section that I was working rather than the bulls, the correctional officers that had been there for quite some time. They were in the old school and they used to still go in the KKK, Ku Klux Klan with the white, and beat the prisoners up. And black and bash them and all that sort of thing. So there was actually a divide while I was there. And I could see myself, when I was working in a different area within the prison, the difference between the prisoners
Absolutely.
How subdued and a lot more aggressive the others were, rather than how I was trained to treat them like human beings.
Precisely, and it makes a lot more sense. Everybody knows that in our system here, that once a prisoner does get released, many of them actually go back to jail afterwards, again creating the small problems for society, taking away more of your tax dollars to build more prisons and stuff. It's just a stupid system. But, you know, again, if you do treat them with kindness, it's absolutely true. Just recently when I was travelling, I saw there was a new movie about the Cray brothers. If anyone knows about Ronnie and Reggie Cray, those were the most notorious gangsters in the East End of London. And they made a movie called Legends about them recently, Reggie and Ronnie Cray. And they were murderers, and they caused a huge amount of havoc, and especially the brother, they were both twins, was it Ronnie Cray, that he was a bit mad. But so he was put in the prison, a very well-known prison in the UK called Broadmoor. It was for the criminally insane. But later on in his life, Ronnie Cray became a Buddhist. So because he was a Buddhist, I went to see him once. And this was one of the most notorious of gangsters. You know, so notorious, they've made a film about him and his brother recently. A really notorious gangster. So I went to see him, and he was very happy to see me, shook my hand and said, "Oh, when I get a few quid, I'll send it to your monastery." And that's what he said. Never made a few quid because he died in jail. But, you know, sometimes you wonder, where is this gangster? Just a really nice guy. So, and that was one of the most notorious gangsters. I've met some interesting people in my life, from the most notorious gangster in the East End of London to Queen Elizabeth, and to many politicians, and sometimes it's hard to tell the difference. I could refuse that. Anyway, so it's a good point there. So this was learning how to discipline someone without force. And I think now many of you may understand it's a very radical teaching which I've been doing over the years, to discipline your mind without force. People sometimes don't get it, but it's the way the Buddha taught. Anyway, the next one, 14. And this is actually 15 and 16 and 17, the different types of people. We start with nobles. You know, the caste system in the time of the Buddha. Again, Venerable Sir, I have seen here certain learned nobles who were clever, knowledgeable about the doctrines of others, as sharp as hair-splitting marksmen. I think it's easy to understand that metaphor. They wander about, as it were, demolishing the views of others with their sharp wits. Now, the debaters, the sort of people who go on the Q&A TV program, the ones who just go in there and try and just destroy another person's ideas just because of the power of their intellect. But, you know, sometimes that's, are you destroying the argument or are you destroying the idea? So anyway, when they hear the recluse Gotama, that's the Buddha, will visit such and such a village or town, they formulate a question thus. We will go to the recluse Gotama and ask him this question. If he is asked like this, he will answer like this, and so we'll refute his doctrine in this way. And if he's asked like that, he will answer like that, so we will refute his doctrine in that way. So the people who have this idea of being superior just by arguing with people and proving that they are better because they can defeat a person in argument. And of course there's all sorts of wonderful stories. I'm just filling out this little talk. One of these stories was of another minister story. I've got a couple of minister stories, but I put one in my latest book, Good Bad Who Knows. This is one which wasn't in there. There was once a minister in a court somewhere in some kingdom, And again, there's always jealousy in politics, in any organization, especially in court, where if you are preferred, you get many, many benefits, even more money. And so this minister was always really smart, always was preferred by the king, was giving all sorts of stuff, which made the others really jealous. So they wanted to cut him down to size. So they decided to work on his pride. And one evening they said in front of the king, "You're so happy, you're so lucky to have such a minister." And he said, "This minister knows everything, don't you?" And out of pride the minister says, "Yes, I know everything." "Yeah, okay, so you probably also know how many stars there are in the sky." He said, "Yes, I know how many stars there are in the sky." "Okay, prove it," said one of the other ministers. "Easy. Please come out on the balcony at night time together with the king." So this smart aleck minister went to this minister who was trying to pull him down in front of the king. He said, "Your Majesty, you point to a star and I will pluck one hair out of this man's head. And you point to a second star, I'll pluck another hair out. And I guarantee by the time we point to the last star in the sky, I'll be on the last hair of this minister's head." And the minister said, "Okay, I believe you. You're right. That is how many stars are in the sky, the number of hairs on my head." And there's always nice little stories like that of how people can actually defeat smart aleck people who try and defeat you with their arguments. There's always another way around. So, these people go around trying to demolish the views of the Buddha. And they hear the Blessed One, the reckless Gotama, has come to visit such a town, a village. So they go to see the Blessed One. And the Blessed One instructs, urges, rouses, and gladdens them with a talk on the Dhamma. And after they have been instructed, urged, roused, and gladdened by the Blessed One with a talk on the Dhamma, they do not so much as ask him the question. So how could they refute this doctrine? In actual fact, they become his disciples. This too, Venerable Sir, is why I infer, according to the Dhamma, about the Blessed One. The Blessed One is fully enlightened. The Dhamma is well proclaimed by the Blessed One. The Sangha of the Blessed One's disciples is practicing in a good way. They try to refute him with their intellect. But when they actually hear the Dhamma, all their questions vanish. And I know I was talking to people in Hong Kong one of the times. That sort of happened to me, but I wasn't going to this monk trying to refute him. I just had some serious questions to ask. And that was a Thai monk, Ajahn Tate, many years ago. Had all these really important questions to ask him on the Dhamma, and it was a wonderful experience. As soon as you went into this monk's presence, all of your questions evaporated. You didn't have any questions. Your mind was so peaceful, so still, and so happy. And I can understand how people would come into the presence of a Buddha, and all their questions, which are all coming from a lack of peace, a lack of contentment, all vanish. And you feel just so happy, so peace. The meaning for questions is all taken away, and so you're just really, really at peace and happy. And so I was just sitting there and said, "What do you want to ask?" I couldn't ask anything, except I didn't want to leave. So eventually they took me away and hadn't made me go out. But I could have stayed there all my lifetime. So the same thing with certain learned Brahmins, learned householders, and even other recluses. They do not so much as ask him a question, so how could they refute his doctrine? In actual fact, the Blessed One, in the case of the recluses, allows them to go forth from the home life into homelessness, and he gives them the going forth. They actually convert. I know some of the monks in England would always tend to go to a local Benedictine monastery a long time ago, but they got banned because a couple of the Benedictine monks became Buddhists as a result. So they said, "We don't want these Buddhists anymore, keep away. We're losing our members." So this is what happens when the learned recluses, they don't ask him any questions, they can't refute the doctrine. In actual fact, they ask the Blessed One to allow them to go forth from home life into homelessness, and the Buddha gives them the going forth. And not long after they have thus gone forth, dwelling alone, this is an important way of becoming enlightened, they have gone forth dwelling alone, withdrawn, diligent, ardent and resolute. By realizing for themselves with direct knowledge, that means a personal experience, this direct knowledge, not what you read in books, not what you hear from monks, what you experience from yourself, the direct knowledge, they here and now enter upon and abide in that supreme goal of the holy life, full enlightenment, for the sake of which clansmen, basically people, rightly go forth from the home life into homelessness. And they say, thus we were nearly lost, we were nearly perished, for formerly we claimed that we were recluses. No, we're not really recluses. We claim that we are Brahmins, so we're not really Brahmins. We claim that even we were enlightened, though we are not really Arahats. But we are recluses, but now we are recluses, now we are Brahmins, now we are Arahats. This too, Venerable Sir, is why I infer, according to the Dhamma, about the Blessed One. The Blessed One is fully enlightened. The Dhamma is well proclaimed by the Blessed One, and the Sangha of the Blessed One's disciples is practicing the good way. And go to the last page here. Is there any questions so far on this? Comments? Good. Again, Venerable Sir, Isidatta and Purana, my two inspectors, eat my food and use my carriages. I provide them with a livelihood and bring them fame. These were like two senior, you might call them these days, civil servants of the Buddha. And it's interesting that later on, when Isidatta and Purana died, that people asked, what happened to these two? This is in the Anguttara, and it's a story which often stands out. And he said they were both once returners, Sakadagamis. In other words, they would come back to this earth once more, and in this next lifetime they would become fully enlightened. And people were quite surprised that there was a difference there, because one would always keep the precepts, the eight precepts, the other one had a wife and basically lived like an ordinary layperson. And they said, how come that one is, they're both actually the same? And he said to them that one, their conduct is really, really good, but their wisdom is not so good. The other one, their wisdom is so strong, but the conduct hasn't really followed after it. And it's interesting, well, there's two ways, you know, the conduct, actually how you're practicing, but also your wisdom, why you're practicing like that way. One had a very, very good conduct, but not as much wisdom as the other. The other one has huge wisdom, but not as much conduct. And it showed just how difficult it is to judge another person. But they were both once returners. So this is just how they were very advanced in their practice. They were working as inspectors for the king. They provided with livelihood. Yet despite this, they do not do such honor to me as they do to the Blessed One. I'm their employer. They honor you much more than they honor me, their employer. For example, once when I had gone out leading an army and was testing these inspectors, Isidatta and Purana, I happened to put up in very cramped quarters. Then these two inspectors, Isidatta and Purana, after spending much of the night in talk on the Dhamma, lay down with their heads in the direction where they had heard the Blessed One was staying, and with their feet towards me. Now, you know that is the Buddhist custom. You know, we often talk about it here. You shouldn't point the feet to the Buddha, or point the feet to sort of the monks or whatever. It's not a Thai tradition. It's an ancient Indian tradition of respect. It's just how you would show respect to people. And so these two employees of the king would point their feet at the king, just because their head had to go to the Buddha. The Buddha took preference there, which was actually quite shocking to a king to see just how much they would respect the Buddha, even just with these little rituals and traditions of that time. And I thought, it is wonderful, it is marvelous. These two inspectors, Isidatta and Purana, they eat my food and use my carriage. I pay them and bring them fame. Yet in spite of this, they're not respectful towards me, because they're more respectful towards the Buddha. He said, surely these good people perceive successive states of lofty distinction in the Blessed Mother's dispensation. They have such incredible respect to you. And this too, Venerable Sir, is why I infer, according to the Dhamma, about the Blessed One. The Blessed One is fully enlightened. The Dhamma is well proclaimed by the Blessed One. The Sangha of the Blessed One's disciples is practicing the good way. So his faith is just seeing just what happens with some of these two very well regarded disciples of the Buddha, and how much they would actually respect him, even against their employers. So I often tell you that if there is a big occasion at the monastery or Dhammasara or Waisak or something, remember, out of respect to the Buddha, you have to come. You don't respect your employer as much as you respect the Buddha. Anyway, again, Venerable Sir, and this is just about his friendship, not so much about respect. The Blessed One is Katiya, the noble, and I am a Katiya. The Blessed One is a Kosalan, and I am a Kosalan. Now the Kosala, again, he was a Sakyan, but Kosala was actually regarded themselves as containing the Republic of the Sakyans. And also here it says, the Blessed One is 80 years old, and I am 80 years of age, the same age. And this also, it's very rare we have this in the suttas, because of his statement here, it actually puts this sutta at the very end of the Buddha's life. 80 years of age. Now remember, when it says 80, the Buddha died at 80. When you say 80, it means his 80th year, hasn't completed the full 80 years. So when a person is born in Sri Lanka or in Thailand, when they're born, they're one. And then sort of it means they can always drive a car 1 year earlier than they can in Australia. No, it doesn't work that way. But nevertheless, that when it says 80, that they were both at the end of their life. So since that is so, I think it is proper to do such supreme honour to the Blessed One and to show such friendship. And I thought it was a wonderful little personal vignette again of the Buddha to see as one of his really close friends. Yeah, there was a great teacher and a king, but when they took off their turbans and they were just together again, they were like very, very good close friends. And now, Venerable Sir, said the king, we depart, we are busy and have much to do. You may go, great king, at your convenience. The king of Kosala rose from his feet, and after paying homage to the Blessed One, keeping on his right, he departed. And what it doesn't say there, which is said in the commentaries, that when he was talking to the Buddha, that general to whom he gave his sword and turban took it away and gave it to King Prasenadi's son, and they took over the throne, and King Prasenadi was killed. That was, you know, the last day of King Prasenadi's life. So, you know, this is what happens in politics. If you go and see the Buddha and you take off your insignia of you're a king, it's very easy to give it to somebody else. And it was a lot of stuff going on with the last time that apparently the king had killed that general's uncles and relations, something else a long time ago. So it was a time the general could get his own back at the king. And this was, again, the King Prasenadi's last day of life. It was wonderful to spend your last day with the Buddha, expressing such friendship. And anyway, then soon after he had left, the Blessed One addressed the monks thus, Bhikkhus, before rising from his seat and departing, this King Prasenadi, because this was all said in the Buddha's room, so the monks would not have heard it. Before rising from his seat and departing, this King Prasenadi uttered monuments to the Dhamma. Now we put monuments, statues and stuff to recognize and to pay respects to important people or important events. And if ever you go to Europe, you have oh, all these arches and these squares, Nelson's Column, to celebrate wars and celebrate great generals and great violence, but this is actually celebrating something much more important than that, but not in stone, in a teaching. That's why it's called a monument to the Dhamma. The Buddha said, learn the monuments to the Dhamma, because master the monuments to the Dhamma, remember the monuments to the Dhamma. The monuments to the Dhamma are beneficial, monks, and they belong to the fundamentals of the holy life. And especially just when it starts to say about just the respect, the friendship, the ability to discipline without force or without violence, the ability to have such, again, the discipline that no one actually misbehaves, and also the happiness in the faces of people who are practicing the Dhamma, the smiles which are natural when you actually develop, and the fact that when you do practice the Dhamma properly, that monks or nuns, they don't want to leave, and they stay for the whole life, and people want to become monks and nuns. So these are the monuments to the Dhamma. Shows that this is something really incredible. That is what the Blessed One said, and the monks were satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words. So, any comments anybody has about the monuments to the Dhamma Sutta? Uh-oh, we got something from overseas. It has been broadcast. Here we go. They're from the United States and from Canterbury, UK. How can one use this teaching to help with choosing wise choice when facing difficult choices or dilemmas? I know that if you discipline your mind with kindness rather than with force, then you'd allow the decisions to make themselves, which they most often do. If a decision is to be made, I ask people to get as much information as you possibly can so you're not making a decision through stupidity. And then once all the information is in your brain, just leave it alone. Wait for the answer to come up. Wait for the computation, if you like to use that word, to actually, you know, go through its phases. And so often just answers come up to you. And yes, they're usually really good answers, very intuitive answers. But if you keep thinking about it and try and discipline and force your mind to find an answer, you just put the answer off more and more and more. And the second thing, which is not from this teaching, but another piece of advice which I often give, it doesn't matter which choice you make in most 99% of situations. Whether you go left or whether you go right, and the forks in the road of your life, whether you go left or right is not as important as what you do after you go left, or how you practice after you go right. Going left, going right, basically, it's successful depending on what you do after you make that choice. It's not really the choice which is important, it's what you do after you make the choice. So if you go left, you make the left option work. If you go right, you make the right option work. And I think that's, I found that in my life is the most important, which takes away the fear of making choices. You just put the information in, let the choice come to you. Or the other simile I did in my book is right. Choices are like you're at the crossroads of life, not the forks in life. You're at the crossroads in life, you don't know whether to go left, right, ahead, or just go backwards. So what should you do? You should sit down and wait for the bus in this simile. Because when a bus comes, on the front of every bus, there's a sign saying its destination. So, if that's a destination where you want to go, get on a bus. If that destination is not appealing for you, just sit down, because there's always another bus behind, coming next, and wait for the one which is your destination. The next question here, nothing to do with... Okay. I have bitten my nails since I was a child. I've been able to stop for short periods of time, but always do it again. It's because of nerves and also my habit. I do when I'm not thinking about it. Is there a way of disciplining myself with kindness to stop biting my nails, which makes my fingers sore? Certainly. As one thing which I've called, and you've heard this before, it's not really to do with the sutta today, which is the programming your mindfulness. So when you are in a situation, when you know you are calm, peaceful, alert, that when you are sensitive to such programs, you sit down quietly, close your eyes, and you give your mind the instructions. In this case, I will not bite my fingernail. I will not bite my fingernails. I will not bite my fingernails. Eyes closed, in your own words, saying it slowly, and most importantly, paying full attention. The more calm, the more alert you are, the more powerful it becomes. If you try that when you're busy or you're tired, obviously it won't work because it depends upon how strong your mindfulness is. If you have very, very strong mindfulness at that time, you're listening to it, it actually does rewire your brain, changes habits. And how that works for you is you put that information in, maybe do it 3 or 4 times, maybe for a week, I don't know. And then you're about to bite your fingernails, and this instruction just comes up. You know, you don't think it, you just remember, oh, I mustn't bite my fingernails. So it gives you the option of stopping. It's not just an old habit which you do and you don't realize you're doing it. You're already biting your fingernails before you realize it because it's such an ingrained habit. Programming mindfulness interrupts those ingrained habits by literally rewiring your brain, giving yourself another option. In this case, no, I won't. And then you find it is overcome. It is a disciplining through mindfulness as well as kindness, and that works pretty well. So even though that's not got too much to do with the sutta today, I hope that's useful for those two people asking questions. The United States and the UK didn't realize the sutta classes listened in such a wide audience. So are there any questions here from people about the sutta today, the monuments to the Dhamma? That is excellent because I have to go, as you know, to church for interfaith. And these interfaiths, just to let you know why I do this, is because that I've been doing this ever since I first came to Perth. And when this centre became available, it was an Anglican church, the community hall. And the what we call the reception area was the vicar's quarters. And this was a car park here. And when we were interested in buying this property and we put in a bid for it, because it was an Anglican church before, they had to go to the Anglican hierarchy to have it approved. And when they said, oh, the Buddhists, yes, we know the Buddhists, they come to this ceremony to help us every year. So, okay, yes, they can buy it. So it's because we went to this particular ceremony for the last 32 years. This is one of the reasons why we're sitting here today. Little acts of kindness, you know, trying to work with people of other faiths, they actually have given a real tangible benefit, the ability to have this center here, which used to belong to the Anglicans. And of course it also helped us having no problem with planning permission, because there was a church before, a religious place before. We didn't need to actually have to go through all the shenanigans with having a temple in the middle of the suburbs, because the Anglicans were here first. We just changed the religion, but it was still for religious purposes. So that's why I'm going this afternoon. Okay, I thought I'd just let you know that. Okay, so let's pay respects to the Buddha Dhamma Sangha.
Arahaṃ sammāsambuddho bhagavā buddhaṃ bhagavantaṃ abhivādhemi suvākkhato bhagavata dhammo dhammaṃ namasami. Supatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Sanghang Namami.
There you go. Another 10 minutes. Yeah. Oh, really? Yeah. I go to church. Anglican, St. George's. Of course. I need to go to Holy Papers.